Hello. So we're back from our last lecture. What we saw from our, the last lecture was that Kant had provided a number of illustrations, four to be exact. And of course, we were talking about contradictions in conception and contradictions in will, and the distinction to be made between those two types of contradictions. But essentially, what we were after was ways in which maxims might fail the formula of universal law. And I, of course, told you that a maxim can fail the formula of universal law in one of two ways, right? That it can either lead to a contradiction in conception or a contradiction in will. And so those four examples were, again, illustrations of what Kant believes goes wrong when I do something that is a violation of the formula of universal law. So, essentially, I think it's the case that Kant builds on behalf of the formula of universal law is quite plausible, right? Historically, Kant has been chided for, chided because he seemed to believe that the categorical imperative could motivate us. A number of philosophers have suggested that the categorical imperative was empty, right, in the sense that it would not provide us with a motivation to behave in any particular way, that we needed something more. Now, whether or not that criticism remains valid is certainly a valid claim, not a claim that you know enough about Kant to really judge, I think, at this point. But to be honest, it is a concern that we'll have to raise perhaps in a future lecture. But for all of that, again, the illustrations that Kant provides do give us reasonable or even plausible evidence to suggest that what Kant has to say is right, and so perhaps he can avoid the charge of emptiness, right? The argument or objection to Kant, again, being that the categorical imperative is simply empty, devoid of content, not able to motivate human beings properly. So, let's imagine for the time being at least that Kant can avoid that objection. I want to raise two other possible problems for Kant at this point, and expose you to some problems that ultimately I think we'll be able to solve these problems, but they're problems nevertheless that you should be aware of as we go forward. Problem number one, these two problems, number one and two, are similar. They're almost inversions of one another, and so we'll take a closer look at them. So problem number one is this. It appears to be the case that good, harmless maxims will sometimes fail the formula of universal law. Right? In other words, it appears that the formula of universal law will fail maxims that we intuitively believe should pass without any trouble. Right. So, in other words, there may be points in our lives where we want to behave in a particular way with motivations that appear to be benign. Yet the formula of universal law tells us that we can't behave in the particular way we wish to. This is a problem for Kant, perhaps. So, what am I talking about? Well, look. If my maxim were something like this, I will go to Angelina's for lunch today. Angelina's, of course, is an Italian restaurant nearby. And it doesn't appear like there's anything wrong with going to Angelina's for lunch. Seems like, a lot of people eat there every day, and they're not doing anything immoral, for the most part, it seems, right? But there isn't anything wrong with eating at Angelina's. So why does it fail the formula of universal law? Well, intuitively we think it shouldn't fail, but why would it? Why even think it should fail? Well, of course, given the formula of universal law and given what the formula of universal law asks of us, it follows that if everyone, right, were to proceed upon a maxim like that, that it would be impossible to follow through, right? So given the mechanisms that Kant has already set up, right, given the systematicity of his moral philosophy, the idea is that we should follow through in the same manner with any maxim that we might want to behave upon, right? So we have to be concerned with universalization. In this case, just as we are in cases where we think we might be doing something immoral. So what do? Well, I imagine, of course, I will go to Angelina's for lunch. Now, you know, I imagine a possible world where everyone is going to Angelina's for lunch, right, here in Panama City. And everyone is, we're talking about 6 billion people converging on Panama City on 23rd Street, you know, trying to get into Angelina's for lunch. Now, of course, this would be very bad, right? No one would get any food that day, of course, maybe the first 100 patrons or something. But beyond that, you know, none of us are going to get fed. And so it makes no sense to believe that this maxim could be passed, right? But why? You know, obviously, there's nothing wrong with going to Angelina's for lunch. Well, perhaps another problem is, you know, that I'm not even in Panama City, right? I'm in Paris, France, and I'm willing that I should go to Angelina's for lunch. Well, that wouldn't make any sense at all. So here's the problem. The problem simply is that stupid maxims will fail the formula of universal law, right? Or rather than stupid, we should just call them simple-minded maxims, right? So maxims have to be, they have to, of course, be grounded in the conditions in which we find ourselves, like I've been saying all along, right? So it would be important for me to, of course, recognize that when I am in Paris, France, it really makes no sense for me to will that I should go to Angelina's for lunch. And of course, we know that, normally speaking, I wouldn't really will that I should go to Angelina's for lunch. And so it only makes sense for me to will that I will go to Angelina's for lunch if indeed I have enough money to eat there, and you know, if I'm hungry, if it's lunchtime, and you know, if I like Italian food. And all of those conditions, again, have to be met before it makes sense for me to want to go there. Otherwise, I won't be motivated to act on that maxim, right? And again, the idea here is that simple-minded maxims will indeed fail the formula of universal law. So this first problem is not really that serious a problem for Kant. All he's asking us to do is think very seriously about how we construct our maxims, and of course, especially that we ought to ground our maxims in our own lives, right? In our own particular wants and desires. Those things are not irrelevant to how we should apply the formula of universal law. In fact, as I've said on a number of occasions, the formula of universal law can't really speak to us in our own, our own situations, our own particular circumstances, if we just consider all of those particular circumstances to be irrelevant. And unfortunately, that's all too often the way Kant is understood. And of course, Kant becomes a kind of whipping boy for, as I've suggested over and over again, this is a gross misunderstanding of Kant, and Kant should not be read in that way. Okay, so that's the first problem. The second problem is much like the first one, but it's far more serious, it seems. Just like good harmless maxims would fail the formula of the universal law, it's also conceivable that very harmful maxims would actually pass the formula of universal law, right? Very harmful maxims would pass the formula of universal law. And of course, if this is the case, then there must be a serious breakdown in the kind of mechanics that Kant is trying to construct, right? Such that, you know, his moral philosophy would really be useless. It wouldn't really tell us how to live a moral life at all if it did allow, you know, people to commit acts of murder, for example. And so this is a very serious worry, and this is ultimately what I'm after. Now, you know, my name, of course, is Kenneth West. You know that by now. And, you know, from time to time, I've actually had an occasion to meet someone with my own last name, you know, in my hometown, not a relative at all. I knew a man by the name of Mark West, and, you know, he may have been some distant relation, but, you know, we didn't really acknowledge him as part of our family. He was part of another family. And I'm sure you've had similar experiences. People share our last names. And it's even conceivable that someone might even share my first and last name. Right, so such that you might even try Googling your name at one point and notice, you know, what comes up. If I Google my name, for example, a number of different things come up. You know, and in fact, there was even a professor, I believe, at the University of Arkansas that, you know, teaches, I think, biochemistry. You know, he has my name. Well, of course, it's not me. You know, we just happen to be professors. But, you know, so it's not the case that my name is terribly, rare or anything like that. You know, there are lots of Kenneth Wests out there. But I do know this, right, that I am the only Kenneth West that actually works at Gulf Coast Community College. I'm the only Kenneth West that is in the that teaches philosophy in the social sciences division here at the college. So, you know, here's the problem. It appears as though I can tailor make my maxims such that they would still qualify as being universalized, but would only apply to me. All right, so here's what I have in mind. If your name is Kenneth West, and you work at Gulf Coast Community College, and you teach philosophy, and you were born on March 3rd, you know, then it's morally permissible for you bring a machete to school and hack a student to pieces or something like that, right? Now, the question is, would this maxim pass the formula of universal law? And of course, intuitively, we think, well, obviously it's immoral to hack a student to pieces, right? That's not something that, that should pass the formula of universal law. If Kant's philosophy, his moral philosophy, is worth anything, it should be able to tell us that something that morally wrong should be forbidden, right? The trouble is that it looks as though this maxim will actually make it through the test, right? It will pass the formula of universal law. We might want to ask why. Why does it pass? Well, notice that when I universalize it, right, when I imagine a world in which all the people named Kenneth West who work at Gulf Coast Community College, who teach philosophy in the social sciences division, who were born on March 3rd, see, all of those people can hack students to pieces using machetes. Now, what happens when I universalize a maxim given those restrictions? Well, it only applies to me, right? And so, in this case, it seems like even after I universalize it, it only applies to me, in which I don't have any problems with a world in which everyone named Ken West is doing these sorts of things, right? And obviously, this is a serious problem for Kant. Now, if this obtains, if this is really true, if this really follows from what Kant has to say, then again, his moral philosophy wouldn't be worth the paper it's written on, right? So how do we help Kant out? Well, the idea seems to be that that we're worried about, what are we worried about? We're worried about exceptions, right? Now, I said earlier that whenever I'm making an exception of myself, I'm probably violating the formula of universal law in some sense, right? In fact, this is the telltale sign of Kant's philosophy. How do I determine when I'm doing something immoral? Well, the best way is to ask yourself, are you making an exception of yourself, right? Are you doing something that you wouldn't want anyone else to do? And Kant says, whenever we are doing something like that, we ought to reconsider, because it's more than likely the case that we are doing something. I mean, one thing we could say is that you can't use proper names, right? Can't use proper names when you're constructing a maxim. But that just seems, like an ad hoc solution to Kant's problem here, right? Why is it that I can't use my name when I'm constructing a maxim? That just doesn't seem right. Perhaps on some occasions my name would be relevant to, the particular conditions under which I find myself. So, maybe we could readjust or rethink how we first constructed the formula of universal law. You remember, of course, that Kant first said that I should act only on those maxims that can be willed as universal laws, right? Maybe we need to reconsider how we've thought about the formula of universal law up until this point, right? We could say that I ought to act only on those maxims that everyone can will as universal laws, right? Not just that I can will as universal laws, but that everyone can will as universal laws. And of course, this would be a modification of Kant's earlier formulation. of the categorical imperative, right? Act only on those maxims that everyone can will as universal laws. Okay, now that's not a bad solution, and a lot of people have thought we need to go that way, right? And it seems to sort of capture what Kant was initially after, right? I have to behave in a particular way that everyone could behave, right? Of course, that doesn't entail that I have reason to do everything that everyone else has reason to do. All it means is that I've got to limit myself to performing actions that everyone could perform, right? And that's really all that Kant has in mind. Let's see. Another possible solution was developed by a philosopher by the name of John Rawls, who taught at Harvard and probably died, I don't know, maybe 6, 7, even possibly 8 years ago. Hasn't been dead very long. But Rawls was a phenomenal philosopher, primarily a political thinker, and wrote a very important book called A Theory of Justice. And in The Theory of Justice, Rawls develops something called the veil of ignorance. Now, Rawls, by the way, considers himself a Kantian in many ways. He certainly stands within that tradition. And as I say, he develops the veil of ignorance and essentially asks us to will our maxims from behind the veil of ignorance, right? So it wouldn't be appropriate for me to act on any maxim unless I first willed that maxim from behind the veil of ignorance. Now, what is the veil of ignorance? Well, Rawls thinks of the veil of ignorance kind of like, I don't know, a curtain in some sense, right? So I stand behind this curtain, which is a kind of veil of ignorance, right? And from behind the veil of ignorance, there are certain things about myself that I'm not entitled to, that I have no awareness of, right? So for example, from behind the veil of ignorance, I wouldn't know whether I'm rich or poor. I wouldn't know whether I'm black or white. I wouldn't know whether I'm a U.S. citizen or whether I'm a citizen of the Saudi Arabia, right? What else? I wouldn't be entitled to information about, my family, for example. I don't know, other information. I might not even know my name from behind the veil of ignorance, right? So immediately what you begin to see is that from behind the veil of ignorance, we are all equals, right? That's essentially the function of the veil of ignorance. It creates a level playing field from behind which we must think through what kinds of maxims we would like to see acted upon in the real world, right? So here I am standing behind the veil of ignorance, and now I want to will that maxim that I thought about earlier, right? If your name is Kenneth West, and you work at Gulf Coast Community College, and you teach philosophy in the social sciences division, and you were born on March 3rd, then it's morally permissible for you to take a machete to school and hack a student up. Well, what if I try to will this maxim from behind the veil of ignorance? What would happen? Well, I would be very less likely to want to will such a maxim to become a universal law. Why? Well, would I want to instantiate a world where everyone were acting on such a maxim, right? First of all, the answer to that question is no. But look, from behind the veil of ignorance, I'm not going to instantiate a maxim like that because, after all, I could be one of the students getting hacked up, right? I don't know who I am. I don't know that my name is Kenneth West from behind the veil of ignorance, right? So I might imagine myself a victim rather than the perpetrator of such a crime, right? And in that case, I wouldn't want to will a maxim like that to become universal law because, of course, it doesn't serve my interests to be getting hacked up by a machete, right, and some crazy professor. So the veil of ignorance is a nice touch, and it does seem to help mitigate Kant's position on on this, and ultimately this is a problem that Kant simply overlooked. It's not something that he really reflected on and thought, well, I could tailor make my maxim. These are problems that really come up after Kant had been around for a while, we're talking about developments that really have been observed in the last 30 or 40 years, and since that time there's developments, we can imagine possible answers Rawls, of course, comes on the scene and thinks, you know, we can solve this problem using the veil of ignorance, perhaps, right? So, and the veil of ignorance seems to be a nice solution, as I said, to that earlier second problem. All right. Well, that, you know, that really ends our considerations of the formula of universal law. I want at this point to shift our attention to the second formulation of the categorical imperative, which is Kant's formula of humanity, right? And in order to do that, I will need, of course, to focus on what ends are, right? And ends, that may not come through on the recording, so I want to spell it for you. It's E-N-D-S, right? E-N-D-S, so that's what I'm saying. So Kant has ends, there are particular ends that we might pursue, right? An end is a kind of goal that we might have, or an aim or a purpose that we might have. And Kant thinks, of course, that we pursue ends sometimes for our own sake, right? I mean, if I pick up a particular book in philosophy, like this morning I was reading a book about Nietzsche, that, you know, I have some interest in, you know, and I did that for my own self, right? If I do it for my own sake. So this particular end that I want to have some kind of better understanding of Nietzsche, that is the aim that I have. And so I do that not for someone else's sake, but for my own sake. At other times, we pursue ends that are for the sake of someone else, right? Like I might call my mother on Mother's Day. And, you know, I don't necessarily do that for myself, although, you know, I do enjoy having a relationship with my mother. But, you know, I also have her ends in mind, right? She might have a goal to, you know, have a close relationship with her son, and, you know, I want to oblige her, and I enjoy that relationship myself. So I do it for the sake of my mother, right? I want to make her happy, so I give her a call on Mother's Day. So we pursue ends for our own sake, and we pursue other ends for the sake of others. Kant's question, of course, is not what kinds of ends we pursue, but his question is this, right? Are there any ends that are rationally obligatory, right? Some ends are rationally optional, right? We can pursue them if we want to or not. And other ends are rationally obligatory, right? Of course, when we've already talked about categorical imperatives, right, those ends are rationally obligatory. But when we're considering the formula of humanity, we're considering something else, right? We're considering something that Kant calls ends in themselves, right? Let's see here. So, he asks the question. I'm going to pause this for a minute. I hope it doesn't mess up the recording. If it does, I'll be right back.